Dr. Stan here, and of course this is the time in our programs when we always have to remind you that we are listener-supported. And of course it's rather expensive to be able to be on 25 stations across America, and we buy time from most of the stations. Some of the stations give us a very good deal, and some of them charge us top dollar. But of course we've targeted specific areas. We've targeted California because this is where we live and where our programs are heard, in Northern California on major station, at Southern California on a major station, here in the Central Coast on several stations, and then of stations all across America, internet, shortwave. And we've accomplished what we have because there are people like you out there in the listening audience who believe in what we're doing and want to help us to continue getting out the news behind the news, the story behind the story. So if you believe that we have a message that's important, you believe that America was founded as a Christian nation and that the foundations of our freedom are based upon the principles laid out in the scriptures and laid out within our founding documents, and that we're losing those and we're moving rapidly towards tyranny, and you'd like to do something, don't just sit around and grouse and say, well, what can I do? You can do something. Everybody can do something. And one of the things you can do is help us. We have a voice, and when you are a member of the Radio Liberty family, you become part of that voice. And you become part of our effort to reach people either by radio or by newspaper, by newsletter, and our newsletter is going to be going out very, very soon. That's going out to not only the Radio Liberty supporters, but we send it to many of the movers and shakers across America, and many times we'll pick up other people's publications, and there will be our information. But you see, we're selling ideas, ideas upon which freedom is based. And so it's as simple as picking up your telephone right now and dialing 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. And for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month. You'll get our newsletter. And you can become part of our team, part of the effort to try to bring the message of the truth to people across America. You can write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. That's Post Office Box 95063. Pardon me, that's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. But we hope that many of you out there will want to join in this epic struggle in which we're currently engaged, an epic struggle to determine whether this nation or any nation conceived under God based upon individual liberty can long endure. And this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. James Herson, a professor of law at Trinity Law School in Southern California. And we're talking about the second section of the Declaration of Independence. And basically, Dr. Herson is divided into five sections. The first is the justification for the Declaration. The second is the moral and philosophical basis. The third is the indictment of King George III. The fourth is the denunciation. And the fifth is the resolve. So we're into part two, the part that starts with the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident."
Yes, and we were saying that, you know, we hold these truths. Such a contrast from this relativist, kind of atheist, secular, humanistic philosophy that says there is no truth. Whatever, you know, is true for you may not be true for the other person. That notion of relativism, and it's just refreshing to look back at the founders and know that they held that there was absolute truth that was self-evident. And here again, this most important section of the Declaration has sort of five propositions, five truths.
I'm going to ask if Kevin could come in here. We may have lost our contact with the internet. Go right ahead, Doctor.
Oh, sure. There are five truths that are in this section. One of them is that all men are created equal. And, of course, that's all people are created equal. That the notion that God creates people with equal opportunity and with equal standing under the rule of law, that the rule of law looks at all people impartially. And the second proposition is they, all these people, are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, meaning, as we talked about earlier, that rights don't come from the state. That's in such great contrast. You know, for example, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights will talk about a fundamental right, such as freedom of speech, but it will add a catch. It'll say, well, this right is subject to those restrictions that are provided by law. And that's so different from the way our system is in the Bill of Rights, where it says Congress shall make no law. Congress has no power to interfere with your freedom of speech, and because those rights are unalienable. And actually, that was a typographical error in the Declaration of Independence, but we keep it anyway, the unalienable as opposed to inalienable. But the notion is that you can't transfer these rights. That the word alienable means to transfer. So like you could transfer a piece of real estate, a right to ownership, but you can't transfer these fundamental rights like freedom of speech. And we don't get those rights from the state. We get them from a divine source, from God. And the fourth proposition is that to secure these rights, to make sure that they're protected, that governments are instituted among men. And where does the government get its power? It derives the power from the consent of the governed. This is the social contract theory. This follows John Locke's second treatise on government. And it's that other pillar of our system, the notion of limited government, that there is no power other than the power that comes from the specific provisions of the social contract of the Constitution. And then the last proposition is, after setting all this in motion, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, what ends? Well, that is securing our unalienable rights. It is the right of the people to do one of two things, either alter it or abolish it. And then, of course, there are many in this country who feel that things are just fine the way they are, even though there's de facto law building up and even though there's a departure from these principles. But if we felt as though our government is destructive of these ends, I think we at least have the right to alter it. And in my view, it's to restore and to return, as Radio Liberty is fighting to do with its broadcasts. And all of these propositions are set forth, and each one sort of leads into the other. All men being created equal, endowed by their creator with these rights. What are the rights? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And by the way, I think the order is no accident. The right to life is first, and the right to liberty and pursuit of happiness is second. And life being life from conception to natural death, that life is sacred when you have a theistic paradigm, a theistic worldview. And then that once we identify the rights, that to secure the rights, governments are instituted and they derive their power from the consent of the government. And if the government becomes destructive, we are able to alter or abolish. And once that we've had our justification, we have our moral basis, now we turn to the next section, which I call the indictment.
Okay, fine. And that starts with the history of the present King of Great Britain. Is that where you start that?
Let's see, I have to look at it myself. actually, it's, yeah, that's the transitional
right.
Thing. That's right.
All right, fine. So the history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over the estates. And to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world, and then, of course, they list all of the things that King George has done.
Right. Now, in the previous section, the moral basis, because of the moral consensus of the time, the truths stated were self-evident. And Thomas Jefferson, being a lawyer, now he's getting more legalistic, and he's looking at not something that's self-evident, but something that has to be proven. And therefore, he has a bill of particulars documenting the king's repeated injuries and usurpations, and it lists 28 of these grievances. It's kind of interesting. There are three types of grievances, and it parallels, in a way, some of the grievances that we currently have against the present government. You know, the first group, there's 12 of them, talk about abuses of the king's executive power. He was suspending laws and dissolving legislatures and obstructing justice. Can you imagine? And maintaining a standing army during peacetime, very much like we have today the abuse of the presidential power with executive orders, with the use of military, without congressional participation, implementing international treaties without congressional required congressional ratification or approval. It's very similar. The second group are attacks on the king for combining with others to subject America to unconstitutional measures. And they're really talking about the British Parliament, but that maybe is analogous to when our government combines with these international organizations to affect American sovereignty. It's very similar. And the third talk about the king's violence and cruelty in waging war against the American subjects. So it's building. And that one, for the most part, hasn't happened on a grand scale, but one could compare that with things like Waco and Ruby Ridge, which at least are evidences of small battles that are against American citizens. So there are some parallels to the time that this was drafted to today's time. And one of the very first part of the indictment says about King George, he has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Well, certainly we've had presidents, and our current president, veto legislation that would be good for America and oppose, for one example of that is the veto on the ban on partial birth abortion. There's one that says he has called together legislative bodies and was attempting to fatigue them into compliance with his measures. I don't know what's going on with this Congress, but they certainly seem to be fatiguing into compliance.
No, I think that he's got things on all of them. I think that's the truth of the matter. We know he has all these illegal FBI files. We know he has investigators going out and investigating them. We know he has James Carville and Larry Flint digging up dirt on the members of the Congress. And whether they're fatigued or whether they're just cowardly, I don't know. But there are very, very few of them who have the courage to stand. And he's embarrassed Congressman Dan Burton, Henry Hyde, Helen Chenoweth. You know, he's tried to embarrass Barr. It's part of a program, and it's very difficult to stand up when you're dealing with a man who has the power of the Secret Service, the FBI, and the CIA, and the National Security Administration, and certainly the whole of the radical left will go after anybody who doesn't go along with the government and with the president. I would say that might be fatiguing people.
I think it's an understatement. And then, of course, he has obstructed the administration of justice in George's case by refusing his assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers. And, of course, obstruction of justice was one of the charges in the impeachment trial. And then this is an interesting one. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Well, I think we've just seen the military being used independent of the civil power without a formal declaration of war, and we see that quite often in American history, although this one has a unique quality to it.
Maybe we can discuss that some evening about because you're talking about what's happening as far as NATO and Kosovo and Yugoslavia.
Yes. Oh, we'll have to do that.
Okay.
And for imposing taxes on us without our consent. that's a an interesting timeless charge. And then a blanket statement, we're taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our government. And I think clearly what we've seen is an attempt to fundamentally alter the forms of our government. And that's the, you know, one of my missions, and I know one of yours, is to awaken Americans to that so that we can understand the uniqueness of America and so we can preserve and restore the essence of our system.
Okay.
And so I think that's probably, what the grievances are about. It's interesting, the words that are used are very emotional, and they end with this king's violence and cruelty, where they're talking about the war grievances, because at the time, historically, many Americans didn't suffer the physical and economic hardships of war with Britain, and so there was a need to get their attention, to bring this to their doors. Thomas Paine said that Americans, the evil of British domination had to be sufficiently brought to the doors of Americans. And so the idea of this wickedness of King George III was to arouse the passions of readers and thereby sort of solidify the support of Americans.
Okay, fine. And then, of course, we get to the denunciation.
Yeah, and the denunciation was sort of a requirement because, as I said, American citizens were close to their British brethren. I mean, they were all English culturally and had left Britain, most of them anyway. And they said that they had, in fact, appealed in vain to the people of Great Britain. And they said, nor have we've been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. And we have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations. So that the American citizens had not just appealed to the government, but had appealed to the people of Great Britain.
And then, of course, in the resolution, we suddenly see them talking about appealing to the supreme judge of the world. In other words, they've appealed to the people of Great Britain, but in the final statement, what you would refer to as the resolution now, they appeal to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intention.
That's right.
And do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies.
Yeah, after justifying this action, after setting forth the moral and philosophical basis in the most important section, the second section, and after setting forth the facts in the indictment and setting forth that they had appealed to the British citizens, now all that remained was for Congress to say, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about this? And that's where they have a resolution resolved, and they say, we, therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress assembled, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, and they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown. And so now we have said what we're going to do, and probably the most important part of this resolution is, in fact, the last sentence. It says, and for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And, wouldn't we like to have our Congress have this kind of courage today.
And of course, I think that people read that today without realizing the implications, because this was a treasonous act, and if they were unsuccessful in their efforts, they would be captured, they would be tortured, everything they had would be seized from them. It might very well be that their families would be killed, because the British Crown was ruthless in suppressing of any revolution on the part of its subjects. And so this was basically, in some respects, like signing their own death warrants if they failed in their undertaking to bring freedom to the United States.
Yes, I mean, it's so far from politicians today who are afraid to take a position because they might not be reelected or they may go down in the polls. When they mutually pledged their lives, they literally pledged their lives and their fortunes, all of their property, and then their sacred honor. And isn't that refreshing to see the words sacred honor? And here, this is another example of inevitable writing, because you wouldn't change the order. You know, it was lives, fortunes, and the most important to the Founding Fathers was their sacred honor.
And, you know, we've sort of gotten away with this from this idea of honor. Could you imagine a Bill Clinton pledging his honor? I mean, everybody would just snicker. In fact, who among our leaders today, if they were to pledge their honor, would give it any credence at all? And yet, at the time when the Declaration of Independence was written, personal honor, duty, these concepts were something that were just inherent in the people, and it was inherent in them because of their belief in God, and honor had their honor was based upon their religious beliefs, and their duty was based upon their religious beliefs. Duty, honor, country, those were concepts that men were willing to live for and to die for and to fight for, but who today is willing to fight for duty, honor, country?
No, I still think there are Americans that are willing to. As a matter of fact, some of them are doing it right now, but I do think that it's gone from the public square. It's been extracted away from our culture, and it's so important that we bring it back and an understanding for what that meant. And it's interesting that this style of writing was influenced very much by an English style called prosody, which was sort of a combination of poetry and prose, and these words were meant to be read aloud the way we're doing it. And it started with the words, you know, when in the course of human events, which was a big, broad concept, and it ends with lives, fortunes, and sacred honor, which brings a wonderful unity to the structure of this when it's read aloud. And this idea was not what today is called spin or hype. These were men of honor. Their motives and actions could withstand the closest scrutiny, and they, by putting their names on the document, the credibility that they had was so powerful that it caused a revolution with this amazing birth certificate of our nation.
And many of them did lose their lives, and many of them lost their families, and many of them lost all their property. But not one of them ever betrayed the sacred trust and their promise when they signed the Declaration of Independence.
That's right. They didn't. And it was, again, because of the fact that they had a moral consensus. They shared this theistic paradigm. They shared these self-evident truths that have been just intentionally sort of extracted away from our culture. We're not even allowed to refer to that heritage, even though when we go to Washington, D.C., we see In God We Trust engraved on the walls of both houses, just like it is on our money. We see a prayer room in the Capitol with a glass window depicting Washington in prayer. It has a quotation of Psalm 16, the Ten Commandments, on the wall of the Supreme Court. Biblical quotations in the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Library of Congress, and yet we're supposed to just extract that completely from our culture and worship at the altar of Freud and Nietzsche and Hegel and Marx and John Dewey and all of this influence that came over here and polluted, in a sense, our culture.
And, of course, these were men who really believed that freedom was worth sacrificing everything for. And people have to begin to understand that this idea of individual freedom is based upon the concept of limiting the power of the government over our lives. Liberty and limited government are inseparable. Tyranny and total government go together. And unfortunately, there are people who would destroy these concepts of liberty and replace it with an all-powerful, all-regulatory government, because these are people who really do not believe that there is a God, and they believe that only the all-powerful state can bring about a better world.
Yeah, they believe that the future of mankind, or some sort of a utopian vision where there's an elite few to make decisions for the many, and it appears as though as much control as possible is asserted on all of us. And so the notion, as you well point out, of freedom and limited government, which is the essence of Americanism, is completely abandoned for a total 180-degree opposite philosophy, which is a collectivist notion of, you know, this utopian agenda and a single global authority.
And, of course, these ideas of socialism and of freedom cannot go together. They are exactly the opposite, because one involves the state regulation and the other revolves people looking after themselves. One is based upon the individual taking care of himself. The other is based upon the state taking care of the individual.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, and it appears as though whenever you're trying to strengthen the almighty state, you have to remove those very pillars, those very obstacles to the almighty state, which are those two pillars that we talked about. You have to remove the concept of inalienable rights. And that's one of the very reasons that this theistic paradigm has been under attack, because it's an obstacle to an almighty state. And the same thing with the notion of limited government. That's why we constantly see the expansion of federalism, the expansion of federal agencies, the expansion and of course international expansion of bureaucracy on every level, because that's the natural tendency of government, and that will always be an attack on liberty. And it's inevitable that the normal circumstances, that we have to be eternally vigilant and resist that in order to maintain our system.
Amen to that. Well, Dr. Herson, thank you so much for being with us this evening. It's been an exciting time, and when we get together again, I hope we'll be able to get started on the Constitution, its meaning, and eventually, of course, into the Bill of Rights. But that's for another evening. Thank you so very much for giving us an hour this evening. Bye-bye, and may the Lord be with you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
Great program. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Don't even think about changing that dial.